think we're trying to get to 100% treatment of all the metals that are produced on the vessel.
Technology to reduce marine pollution from cruise ships is back in the state's discussions. And growing up in Haines impresses another U.S. Military Academy admissions office. It's the KHNS Local News. I'm Tara Bicknell. Those stories and more up next. A state committee considering cruise ship wastewater issues continues to look for technology that reduces marine pollution. The legislatively mandated Science Advisory Panel met via teleconference last week. Members refined a request for information about what are called polishing systems, which remove dissolved metals from wastewater discharges. One of the biggest challenges facing cruise lines is how to meet new, stricter standards for dissolved ammonia, nickel, copper, and zinc. They're hazardous to marine life at certain concentration levels. Panel member Michelle Ridgway, a marine ecologist, urged the group to search for the best technology possible.
I think we're trying to get to 100% treatment of all the metals that are produced on the vessel. And if we don't examine it from that perspective, we're always going to be caught in the middle of what are the ship's options, what might they do, versus how much total metal maximum do we want a system to be able to treat, to provide them the option to treat 100% of their waste stream.
The panel's researching technology that can help ships meet strict standards set under terms of an initiative passed in 2006, but they only affect wastewater discharged in state waters. Ships also have the option of discharging in federal waters, further from land, where less stringent standards apply. John Turvey of the Holland American Line told the panel that the industry will not necessarily adopt the recommended technology.
None of this is done in a vacuum. For example, we absolutely have to install ballast water treatment systems in our ships, and that has an economic, contrary to popular belief, we do not have unlimited capital. We certainly don't have unlimited space down below. We don't have unlimited engineering manpower. So my point is, you know, we'll look at it when we figure out what's out there.
State Cruise Ship Program Manager Rob Edwardson says the request for information about polishing systems will go out later this month. The science panel is undergoing a lengthy research process. It'll give the legislature a preliminary report on its findings by January of 2013. A final report is due 2 years later. The panel began meeting about a year ago and includes experts in ship construction, wastewater technology, public health, oceanography, and other fields. There's another study out taking a look at Southeast Alaska economics. This one contrasts logging in the Tongass with efforts to restore habitat and second growth forests. The Wilderness Society study's recommendations parallel some changes already underway, but national forest managers say the way it wants to change things could defeat its own purposes. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Wilderness Society's message is simple. The federal government is spending too much money subsidizing an industry with limited economic returns. Its study says the Forest Service spent about $250 million over the past 8 years supporting timber harvests, and it says only about $7 million came back. Resource economist Evan Yerpa conducted the research for the Society's Alaska office. He says the demand for wood products is down, and logging the Tongass is the wrong way to meet it.
Get this wood from plantations, you can be much more efficient, and it comes from private lands. Producing this wood off of public lands is not only inefficient, it's ecologically degrading.
The Society instead wants the Forest Service to spend its money on restoration efforts. That includes repairing salmon streams damaged by logging and road construction. It also wants more support for thinning thick forests growing back from clear cuts. And eventually, it says the agency should develop environmentally sensitive harvests using some of that new growth.
There's a happy medium that can be achieved where we can still create regional economic impact in the remote forested communities of the Tongass while helping out the overall ecosystems and watersheds of the Tongass.
The Wilderness Society says the transition can be made in a way that keeps employment levels about the same. But Forest Service spokeswoman Erin Uloth disagrees.
The report suggests that Southeast communities give up a set of living wage year-round jobs that exist in the timber industry at the moment in favor of actually fewer and lower paying seasonal jobs. This is not a scenario that we can support on the Forest Service, especially in today's economy.
The Forest Service is already changing its focus in the Tongass. That includes funding more restoration and stewardship projects. But Uloth says a complete transition can't happen as quickly as the Society suggests. That's because the infrastructure would be lost.
So you can't eliminate the industry today and have an industry for second growth down the line. You need the industry to remain intact in order to have a second growth industry. And that's the critical piece that seems to be missing.
The Willing Society does not take a position that there should be no timber harvest on the Tongass.
Society Deputy Regional Director Karen Hertig says the group acknowledges the need for logging, some in Southeast.
We're working with the Forest Service to find solutions for where and how much timber harvest can come off of the Tongass. And we'd like to see more of that in the future come from second growth forests. But we realize it's going to take some time to implement the regional foresters' transition vision.
The Society's report is one of several examining the region's economy to come out this year. The State Labor Department released its annual jobs estimate, projecting about a 1% decline, and Trout Unlimited issued research showing salmon contributing about $1 billion a year to the region. The Forest Service's ULOTH says Trout Unlimited's work shows the agency is a good steward.
The Tongass produces 30% of the U.S. wild salmon catch every year, and we sustain 10% of local jobs, according to the study, with an ongoing timber program operating. So, you know, we would argue that something seems to be working here on the Tongass.
But Wilderness Society economist Yerpa says it could work better. He says old-growth forests, such as those in the Tongass, are rare and need to be protected.
The study suggests that we should be proactive and we should be able to protect these intact watersheds and these abundant salmon-producing watersheds while they're still healthy.
All the reports will be part of the debate as forest managers and stakeholders continue to map out the future of the Tongass. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Blake Hamilton, a senior at the Haines High School, had just arrived home from swim practice when he saw the answering machine light blinking from across the room. The message that awaited him was about to change the course of his life.
I got home, and the answering machine light was blinking, so I just thought it was my dad calling or something. So I ended up listening to the message.
It was Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski with a personal message for Hamilton, who graduates this May.
And, yeah, she just called my house to say that the Academy had called her and that they had offered me an appointment and that I'll be receiving my papers this week.
The Academy he's referring to is the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. Hamilton had begun the lengthy, involved process of applying to the prestigious educational institution years earlier.
Yeah, when I heard the call, I was pretty excited, but none of my family members were home, so there was no one I could tell, so I ended up calling them all frantically to try and find somebody to tell, but no one was picking up, so I ended up calling my friend John Downer first, because I just had to get it out of my system that I was going to Annapolis.
Hamilton had also sent out applications to the University of Washington and the University of Alaska Fairbanks, since he was awarded scholarships to cover a good portion of tuition at those schools.
I received all that scholarship information and as well as admittance information last month, but it was a week ago now. I received a call from Lisa Murkowski saying that I got accepted to the United States Naval Academy, and that was top of my list the whole time, so I've decided to attend that school.
Hamilton isn't the first local student to be accepted to a U.S. military academy. Others have been through the process and attended all the way through graduation. For Hamilton, it began with a preliminary application, then a week at the academy to find out what it's like to live there.
That's what I did this past summer, and that really cemented my drive and my will to want to go to this school. The campus is really full of history, and it's almost surreal to be there because there's so much history there. So that's what struck me first when I went there. But then also the fact that that there's kind of a commons area that anyone can go to, but then the actual campus only Naval Academy attendees can go in there. So to be able to stay in the dorms and go to the classrooms and stuff was a great honor. But when I was there, the thing that stuck with me the most was the people that were attending there. The camaraderie that was between them was so strong because the trials that they had all gone through together had formed this bond that you wouldn't really have among normal college students. So that's what really stuck with me, because I know when I go there, I'm going to make lifelong friends that are going to help me go through all the trials that they're going to set before me at the academy.
Hamilton also went through a formal application process that involved a physical from the Department of Defense Medical Review Board. He had to apply for a nomination from a senator or congressman and get an interview with a retired naval officer in Juneau who wanted to know why Hamilton thought he was a good candidate for Annapolis.
The big thing was why I feel I'm qualified over some other person. And that was actually a major part of the interview, and I focused on the fact that I was from Alaska, and when I went to the summer seminar, I realized that a lot of people down south hadn't had the unique experiences an Alaskan can have, and I think that those experiences really prepared me and put me in a good light for the interview.
Hamilton has a history of military service in his family, which inspired him to make his decision. He's also interested in studying naval architecture or ocean engineering and perhaps eventually getting his nuclear power endorsement and work on submarines.
My dad, Scott Hamilton, owns a 35-foot sailboat, and so we've done a lot of exploring between Seattle and Seward. And so, like, the topic of my admittance essay was about how we went across the Gulf of Alaska and got into a storm and how I handled that situation. And so it's experiences like that and, you know, just living in Haines, being able to climb up Mount Rapinski and snowboard or go to the pass and just all the outdoor activities, you know, strengthened me physically and mentally. And so all those experiences together just made me into a rounded person I think the Academy could use, and that's why I got an appointment.
Hamilton has also been a dedicated member of the Dolphin Swim Team and Glacier Bears Cross Country Track Student Council, National Honor Society, and band. He'll also still be heard as a DJ on KHNS Radio for a while longer, where he interned last semester, before heading to his next address, to the U.S. Naval Academy, ironically located at 121 Blake Road in Maryland. This is Tara Bicknell for KHNS. Thanks for listening.